Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet him, greet him, treat him, and street him. Today's date is February 5th, 2014, and I am your skeptical host of the ER literature, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Take My Shortness of Breath Away, Nebulized Furosemide for COPD. And today, back by popular demand, we have Sweden's favorite skeptic, Dr. Katrin Herska. Welcome back to the S-Gem, Katrin.
Thanks. It's nice to be back.
I hear you're getting all set up for the course that we've got in Sweden in March. How are things coming along for that?
Well, they're coming along just fine. We have a lot of Swedish doctors attending and also doctors coming all the way from New Zealand.
From New Zealand all the way to Sweden.
Yay.
I have to tell you, the Beam Dream team is getting very, very excited. Is there anything special that we need to know before we arrive in Sweden?
No, it will all come as a surprise to you.
Well, I did get a list of questions here on Sweden, and I thought maybe you could answer some of these questions before we arrive. And I came up with a list of five because that's my favorite number. Do you mind just answering these five questions for me?
I'll give it a try.
Thanks. Question number one, why is Sweden called the land of the midnight sun?
Because if you go all the way up to the north in summer, there will be midnight sun.
So the sun doesn't set in Sweden in the middle of summer?
Well, not up in the north. It doesn't set in summer. It doesn't rise in winter either.
Question number two, does everyone drive a Volvo?
Yep.
Okay. Question number three, are all Swedes tall, blonde, and blue-eyed?
Well, I've got green eyes, so I guess that's not true.
So all it takes is one green-eyed person to dispel that myth. Question number four, does everyone listen to the band ABBA? Mamma mia, here I go again. Mama, how can I resist you? Mamma mia,
does it show again? Mama, just how much I missed you. What's that?
Good, okay, that was the right response. And number five of these Swedish questions, does everyone own furniture made by IKEA?
Definitely. Like the rest of the world, more or less.
More or less. Well, thanks for clearing up all those Swedish questions before we arrive from North America. Let's talk about today's podcast, though. I put together a case scenario of a 73-year-old man who presents to the emergency department with an exacerbation of his COPD, or chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. He quit smoking 2 days ago, and when you question him further, he actually couldn't smoke anymore because he was so ill. He has a history of hypertension, but has no history of congestive heart failure. He's been taking all of his medications and his puffers as prescribed. His vital signs are blood pressure 165 over 85, heart rate's 95 and regular, he's afebrile, his respiratory rate is 22, and his O2 saturation is 92% on room air. So the question for today's podcast is, would nebulized furosemide help treat his COPD exacerbation? And Katrin, let's make sure everybody's starting on the same page here. Could you give us a definition of what we mean by COPD?
Well, I can give you the definition by the WHO, and that is that COPD is a lung disease characterized by chronic obstruction of lung airflow that interferes with normal breathing and is not fully reversible. The more familiar terms, chronic bronchitis and emphysema, are no longer used, but are now included within the COPD diagnosis. So COPD is not simply a smoker's cough, but an underdiagnosed life-threatening lung disease.
And the most common cause of COPD, at least in the Western world, is cigarette smoking. And there's no cure for COPD, but we do have a number of effective treatments. And these include the most important and the most difficult maneuver, and that's quitting smoking. The other treatments would be bronchodilating, anticholinergics, and steroids. Pulmonary rehabilitation programs have also been proven to be beneficial. But Katrin, where did they come up with this idea that nebulized furosemide would work for COPD? That seemed a bit wonky for me when I first got the paper.
It has been studied in palliative care patients with severe dyspnea. And there have been quite a few case reports of good effect in those patients.
And I think there's some physiological data thinking it could modulate vagal afferent activity, at least in animal models.
Yeah, well, nobody really knows how it works, but it seems to have an effect on dyspnea, or at least that's what's been hypothesized, that the sensation of dyspnea would be altered.
So let's look at the specific reference. Can you introduce the paper that you picked for this podcast?
The paper is called The Adjunctive Effect of Nebulized Furosemide in COPD Exacerbation, a Randomized Controlled Clinical Trial in Respiratory Care.
And what was the population that they were looking at, Katrin?
This study was conducted in Tehran, the capital of Iran, and they studied 100 patients aged more than 18 with a diagnosis of COPD presenting to the emergency department with COPD exacerbation.
Important, I guess, is the exclusion criteria, and they did exclude people under the age of 18, but also patients with a history of asthma, congestive heart failure, and lung cancer. All of those patients weren't included in this population set. The intervention, like we mentioned earlier, was furosemide. How did they deliver the furosemide to these patients?
Well, they used 40 milligrams of nebulized furosemide.
And then they just compared it to the conventional therapy alone. What were they looking for their primary outcome?
Well, they had two primary outcomes. One was changes in FEV1, and the other one was change in dyspnea severity.
And then there was a bunch of secondary outcomes, but we won't go through those right now because they were a bit more surrogate and they weren't part of the primary study. The author's conclusions were, quote, the addition of nebulized furosemide to conventional therapy improves dyspnea and physiological respiratory parameters in patients with COPD exacerbations. So Katrin, let's go through a quality checklist from an EBM standpoint. And we've had some great, great papers over the last year or so. And I have to say, this one wasn't one of them. But you know what? Even a mediocre paper can really provide us some information because it can point out some limitations, some really good EBM points, and it'll hopefully help people design and structure better studies in the future. So let's go through those quality check questions. The first of which, because we're emergency physicians, was, were these patients focused from the emergency department? Are we looking at ED patients here, Katrin?
Yes, we are.
Question number two, we always want to know if the patients were randomized.
Well, I couldn't really answer that question because it wasn't mentioned more than that. They said that randomization was achieved using SPSS15, which is their statistical software.
And they got 50 patients in each group exactly for that 100. So there were 50 control and 50 in the nebulized treatment group. Were they able to conceal, or did they talk about concealing the randomization process?
No.
Great. Were the patients analyzed in the groups which they were assigned?
I don't know, but I guess they were, since nebulized furosemide is not standard treatment, and this was a short study. The endpoint analysis were performed 1 hour after treatment, so would be hard to have the patients change groups.
And I think you also put in a comment here that when they looked at the mean baseline FEV1, it was 54, which in a stable COPD patient corresponds to moderate COPD. And that indicates that these patients that they were enrolling were not that sick.
Yeah, I guess that's the hardest thing to determine. How sick are the patients who come in with COPD exacerbation?
Well, do we know if the patients were recruited consecutively? Because that's important that we don't have this selection bias going on.
No, we don't know that either because it wasn't mentioned. They did mention that they selected only patients who were clinically stable, which means that they were not in need of mechanical ventilation.
So again, these are not the really, really sick COPDers that are coming in. How about the baseline? You know, we want to make sure that the control group and the treatment group are similar with regards to prognostic factors so that their baseline parameters are the same. Did they mention that?
Yeah, they did. But they do have a problem here because the placebo group was significantly more tachycardic, 101 beats per minute versus 89. They also had less pronounced respiratory acidosis and less compensatory metabolic alkalosis. And there was also a difference if FEV 1% between the placebo group and the intervention group.
So we don't have two equal groups necessarily coming into the study, which could make the interpretation of the results problematic. How about blinding? Were the patients aware and were physicians aware of which group they were assigned?
Well, it was supposed to be blinded, but all furosemide vials were labeled 1 and placebo were labeled 2. So it's possible that someone figured it out which one was which.
Well, I could see that if all the samples labeled 1 had furosemide in it and patients started to have an urge to go number 1, that you could pretty much figure out that the person who really had to go number 1 with vial 1 might have been getting the active ingredient, furosemide, and the person who got the vial number 2 knew that it was crap and it didn't have anything in it, and it was just the placebo. So blinding could have been uncovered there. Didn't they do, or
I think... Well, I'm not so sure about that, because there were at least 2 earlier studies on healthy young people who were giving nebulized furosemide, and in those studies, they didn't find an increased urge to go and urinate.
All right, I'll give that to you, but these are healthy young people in those previous studies.
Are these more likely to respond to furosemide?
All right, we'll give that to you. But I just thought it was interesting that they just put all of 1, vial 1 was the active ingredient, and all of vial 2 was the non-active ingredient.
That was kind of unnecessary.
Were all groups treated equally except for the intervention?
Yes, I would say so.
And did they get at least 80% follow-up with regards to the study?
Well, follow-up was 100%, but they didn't comment any further on that in the paper.
Well, I guess if you get 100%, do you really have to get better than that? How about patient-oriented outcomes? Did they look at patient-oriented outcomes? Were they considered?
Well, I guess the most patient-oriented outcome there is in COPD is dyspnea. And this was one of the primary outcomes.
I like how you said that. It was one of the primary outcomes. How can you have more than one primary outcome? Don't you have a primary or a composite outcome as opposed to, oh, yes, we had 2 primary outcomes?
Well, yeah, I don't understand that. But I know this EBM guru who has his own podcast, so I expect him to explain that to me.
Well, I was a bit mystified how they had 2 primary outcomes. And I agree with you that the most important thing my patients care about when I see them is their shortness of breath. I can't remember the last time a patient asked me when they were acutely short of breath what their FEV1 was.
Those patients are out there.
And then, of course, they had a whole bunch of secondary outcomes. When it came to the results, do you think the results were large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant?
That's very hard for me to say because I don't have dyspnea. They did use the VAS scale, but it was numbered and patients were asked to point to a number instead of pointing to a marking.
So in other words, they had a visual analog scale, like a visual analog score from 1 to 10. But rather than putting an X across where they fell on that visual analog score, they used the ordinal scale and they had to point to 1, 2, 3, or 4, that kind of thing?
Yeah. And I found it strange that the study they used to calculate power had the same scale, but with scores from 1 to 100.
Maybe they were working with millimeters on the visual analog score instead of centimeters. Well, what were the results then? What was the primary outcome? What did they find in this study by treating patients with COPD exacerbations 40 milligrams of nebulized furosemide?
Well, they found a change in FEV1%. It was 11.5 for the treatment group versus 4.9 for the intervention group.
And so that was significant, wasn't it? That was a big difference.
That was significant, and there was also a change in dyspnea score, where the intervention group had 2.7 centimeters less on their VAS versus 1.6 for the placebo group.
So that's a bit harder to interpret with just a sort of a 1.1 drop or difference between the two. And I know with pain scores, I'm pretty familiar with those, that you need at least a 1.3 or 13 millimeters difference to be considered clinically significant. I'm not sure what it is with a shortness of breath or dyspnea score, what would be considered clinically significant. And we know that's the most important patient-oriented outcome.
I found a study on that too. As far as I remember, it was somewhere between 1 and 2.
Okay, so it's just brushing up against clinical significance there with 1.1 difference? Well, from a beam commentary standpoint, I mean, this study was designed to evaluate the hypothesis that nebulized furosemide could improve COPD. However, they did have poor methods, or at least poorly reported methods, because they may have done those things well, they just didn't report them. There was a possibility of unblinding, and I appreciate your concern and feedbacks with regards to the difference between vial 1 and vial 2. They did have multiple surrogate markers, which we didn't go through here today, and then the questionable clinical significance. And in addition, there was no mention of harm in the study. And when we want to look at clinical effect, it's always important to take into consideration what was the benefit, but also what was the harm. So from a bottom line standpoint, we felt that there was no role at this point for nebulized furosemide for the COPD patients until we have more data on the subject. Do you agree?
Yeah, I guess I have to agree.
So for a case resolution, because I like to tie these things up, because we present with a case and I like to finish up with the case. This person who comes in at 73 years old with a COPD exacerbation, we're going to treat him with conventional therapy and we're going to encourage him to stay a non-smoker. It is very hard to quit smoking. So turn it into something positive. If he hasn't felt well enough to smoke for 2 days, maybe this could be for the rest of his life, and turn it into something positive. And of course, at this time of year, we would encourage him to get a flu shot if he hadn't had one already.
Well, all COPD patients in Sweden get flu shots for free.
Same here in Canada. So for the Keener contest, last week's winner was Rory Spiegel, and his Twitter handle is Captain Basil EM. And he knew that Dr. Charles R. Drew was the African-American surgeon who was a pioneer in blood banks, and that pioneering research that he did helped save countless lives during World War I. So congratulations, Rory. And for this week's Keener contest, I will ask you, Katrin, to come up with something from Sweden.
Okay, so when you come to Sweden in March, I will show you where they give out the Nobel Prize.
Woo, I'm getting the Nobel Prize. Is that what you're telling me?
No, because it's not given out in March.
Oh.
Do you know when? Yeah. Do you know when they give out the Nobel Prize?
No, I don't know when they give out the Nobel Prize.
Well, that's this week Keener contest question.
Oh, okay. So if one of our listeners knows when the Nobel Prize is given out, the specific date, you be the first one to email me back the sgem at gmail and use Keener contest in the subject line, and I will send you a cool skeptical prize.
Well, not a Nobel Prize.
No, not the Nobel Prize. It'll be a cool skeptical prize. So we have Steelbeam coming up later this month, and then of course we're all heading to Sweet Beam on March 17th and 18th, and then there is Prairie Beam later in the spring. Katrin, would you give the Skeptic's Guide tagline, but in Swedish, please?
Kom ihåg att vara skeptisk till allting som du lär dig, även om du Först hörde det på The Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
And if you don't speak Swedish, remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on The Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Talk with you next week.